I wouldn't do that.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. This is Literary Viewpoints, and we're going to talk about a literary element today, narrative, narration, narrative point of view, narrative voice, and narrative time. And now, 1 second, there's one more person here, and this has to
Alan,
be Alan Topol.
Yes, it sure is, Fran.
Alan's
how
here,
are
yay.
You?
Okay, everybody's here, and I'm going to introduce
sure.
my panel of experts, and then I'm going to throw the questions out at you, and you get to do the work, and I get to ask the questions. We've got Linda McDaniels, and we've got Christina Hogue. We've got David McCallop, who I'm so glad I bumped into at the Thriller Fest, and Alan Jacobson, whose latest book, Darkness of Evil, is really evil. You got to read it. It's fantastic. That was one of my friend's hour-and-a-half reads, and then I read it again to make sure I got it right. And Alan Topol, and his next book is coming out, The Washington Power Lawyer. I can't wait. Oh, this is so exciting. So, hi, everybody.
Lou.
Hi, Fran.
Good to be friend.
I'm so glad you're all here, and the sun is shining, and the snow decided not to show up today. So that was really great. So we're going to talk about narration. Narration is the use of a written or spoken commentary to convey a story to an audience, in case anybody's listening and all listeners don't know. Narration encompasses a set of techniques through which you, the author, presents his or her story. Some people use narrative point of view, the perspective or personal or non-personal lens with which a story is communicated. Narrative voice, the format through which a story is communicated, and narrative time. I actually did some research here. The grammatical placement of the story's time frame in the past, present, or future. So there are three different types of things. Which one do you use in your writing? Sometimes it's even the character that's presenting the story, and then there's no dialogue. So how do you keep an interest? So which applies to your writing, anybody?
Well, this is Alan Jacobson. I'll kick it off and just say that anytime you have definitions like this, they're guidelines, but they're not rules set in stone. So I can tell you that I use all three aspects of narration, and sometimes all three in the same story. So it really depends on what you're writing and what kind of story you want to tell and through whose eyes you want to tell it. And sometimes I'll mix all of those in one book. Sometimes one book will have more elements of A and B and not C, or, you know, one book will be heavy on C with elements of A and B. So it really depends. And that's the art of what we do. And, you know, being artists, that's what we do. We take a little bit off of the color palette for blue and we mix it with a little red, you know, just to get that right color that we want. And so, you know, it's an art, and the danger of having quote rules is that you can get stuck in the rules instead of just writing to create and letting it organically flow and evolve.
So do you create the plot first and then the characters and then decide what kind of voice?
It comes to me simultaneously. Usually the idea is what comes to me first. If I'm writing an FBI profiler Karen Vale novel, then I already have Karen Vale as the lead character and lead voice. You know, not necessarily. Sometimes I'll know that I want to do something with her. Like when I wrote Inmate 1577 a few years ago, I walked into my office. I was not planning to write this particular novel. I was planning to write something else. I walked into my office and I said, Karen Vale on Alcatraz. It just popped into my head. And that was the idea that I couldn't shake. It kept coming back to me every morning when I would walk into my office. And the idea started to take shape as the days passed. And I started writing it all down. And before I knew it, I had a very complex outline that I had to write it. I was so excited about it. I had to put the other project aside and write that novel, which became Inmate 1577. So in that case, it was a very rudimentary thought that involved a character and a place, not even a storyline, although that storyline quickly came apparent to me.
That's interesting.
I'd say this is Christina Hogue.
I was just going to say, it just really, it voice is something that usually the plot, for me, the plot and character comes first, and then I find the character's voice. And often it just sort of comes out as I write. I had one instance when, you know, I often find the best voice comes out in first person. And, you know, with my novel Skin of Tattoos, I was writing along in third person, and this has happened with other novels I've written, and it just doesn't seem to work. It just doesn't seem to really come alive. And then during a writing workshop class, one of the assignments was write a first-person thing of a character, a little, you know, vignette. And then I started writing in the character of my protagonist, Mags, and all of a sudden it came alive, and I said, okay, this is it. This is, so I ended up writing the whole novel in first-person because I had found his voice. And so I think it sometimes just comes with a process of writing through, and then the voice kind of emerges on you. So I don't know how, it's a very tricky thing is to nail that voice. I've found it one of the hardest things, but it seems to just come organically.
That's interesting. This is Alan Topol. I want to pick up on that because that's really an interesting comment, is what I've been doing in my novel, certainly in my last six or so, is using the shifting point of view among my four major characters and then writing it in third person, but shifting, letting the story evolve from scenes, from shifting points of view of these four characters. They don't get equal time. Craig Page, as Fran knows, when it's a Craig novel and an Elizabeth novel, they clearly have the bigger share, the bigger voice. But I find that this shifting point of view among the four major characters is a, at least for me, and this is of course very subjective, becomes a good way to let the story unfold, because that way I'm into the head of the, and putting the reader to into the head of the villains as well as my heroes, and you know, it just I struck me on it, and then I've sort of stuck with it because it seemed like a good way to just let the story evolve from these shifting points of view. But anyhow, it's subjective, and I just, you know, picking up on the excellent point that was just made a minute ago.
Alan Jacobson here. I just wanted to pick up. Was that Christine? Was that
yes?
The first voice. Okay. So to build on Christine and Alan, when I wrote the first Karen Vale novel, it came to me in the first person. And that was the first time I'd ever written a book in the first person. And I wrote the first 75 pages. I was very excited about it. I sent it to my agent, and she said, no. You've never written a book in the first person. You're going to confuse your readers. You know, this, you got to scrap all this. And I was very upset, to put it mildly, because I thought it was the best thing I'd ever written. And here she is telling me to scrap this character that I was just so excited about, and that's how Karen Vale came to me in the first person. So I figured, you know what, she's been in this business a lot longer than I have. At that point, it was only my third novel, so I was not in the business very long. And I thought, okay, well, she knows better. And so what I did was, this was in the height of my anger, I did a find and replace in Microsoft Word, and I changed all the I's to C, and so on and so forth. And then I sat back and I just read what I had. And I was really surprised. I thought it was going to be, you know, total garbage. And I was just going to, you know, was the next step was be delete. But I read it and I went, wow, this is pretty powerful. So it was in the third person, but it had a first person sensibility to it. I was very close to the reader. And then I changed things further, and I made the first person portion of it, I made into an internal monologue that Vale. So we hear and see Vale's thoughts as she's in a scene. So we're literally seeing through her eyes. We know what's in her head. And so I developed this kind of hybrid point of view for Karen Vale, and I kept it throughout the entire series. So again, you know, you need to have the ability to just let yourself create and not be locked into, well, this should be, you know, narrative point of view A, not narrative voice, or, you know, so on and so forth.
Hey,
but
Alan,
how do you create
email
a narrative voice so that somebody doesn't get, well, in other words, you want to hear the voice of the character, but sometimes when people write in first person, you don't hear any emotion, just like a disconnect. So how do you fix that?
Well, interestingly, I've heard the opposite. Those who write in first person feel that you get more emotion by writing in the first person. And they say, well, how do you get the emotion if you're writing in third person? So, you know, again, it really depends on the character and the writer and how you approach it. But as we all know, as writers, emotion is extremely important, and engagement with the reader comes from the emotional attachment they have to the story and the character. So it's absolutely important to make sure that no matter which point of view you're using and which narrative element, that you maintain that emotion. And if you're writing third person, then you can use actions to show your characters rather than telling, which is not good storytelling, which just always cracked me up. You know, you're not supposed to tell, but the term is storytelling. It should be story showing. So, you know, you show through actions and activities and things that the character does to show what they're feeling. And you can also, you know, you can do a little bit of telling. But it's the actions. If they slam a fist down and they're yelling, you know that they're upset. The emotion is evident. The situation, and if we know our character, the situation that you place that character in will also convey emotion. So, you know, if you know that your character, if the reader knows that your character has claustrophobia and you put them in a tunnel where, you know, there's very little room on either side of their, you know what they're feeling, and then you can show it. So it's not a black and white answer. There's a lot that goes into it, depending upon your character, how developed that character is at that point in the story, and how you go about showing.
That's interesting.
I just want to raise that the a close cousin, as Alan just referred to the first person, is third person close. You know, where you're basically in third person, saying she, he. But you're in that character's point of view, and you're sort of stuck there, you know, trailing that character around. So, but again, I've always found if you're going to do that, you might as well make the next step and just go into first, and then you do get more of that emotion, and you're, I think the reader is more in the head of the character. But again, it's a close call between third person close and first person. And I, too, have heard things that first person somehow distances the emotions. I've heard that criticized about my writing as well, as not enough emotion because it's in first person, which is sort of funny. But I think it's also a balance. I try not to go too much into the telling and the interior monologue. To me, it's always how much interior monologue you have, you know, when it gets to telly, to the reader, that interior monologue. But again, it's always a balance, you know, a lot of things in writing.
This is David McCaleb. I'm sorry, did I interrupt?
No, go ahead.
I'm sorry. David McCaleb here. I write in third person close. Some people call it third person limited. One exercise that I do to kind of help that emotion or that kind of get close is I try to get into role. And so, like, before I write, I'll actually just spend a few minutes going over my character. Okay, who is he? What are his likes? What are his dislikes? And so then when he or she observes the world or the scene, they'll see it differently. Like, for example, in my most recent in my third novel, toward the end, I have a husband and wife going through an airport at two completely different times, but I'm in the head of the wife originally, who's kind of like a financial intelligence analyst. And then I've got him coming through about 6-8 hours later, and he's a military operator. And so the way that they describe the same things are completely different. It's looking at the world from two different angles. But I take time to get into, like, the head of my character and walk through it, not just as they see, but when how you observe the world through sight, through smell, what things, you know, smells are a fantastic way to help draw your reader in, because they really anchor you in a scene. They're different senses, and not just sight, that we can utilize in order to help convey, you know, emotion. Colors can convey emotion. How someone sees something and describes it, you can you can determine whether they are sad or happy. One of the best exercises someone challenged me to do one time was describe the inside of a barn from the perspective of a farmer who just lost his son. And think about that versus describing the inside of a barn from a farmer, you know, who's who just brought in his fall crop. You know, it's different ways that you see the world, and it takes some time to get into your character, and then you can actually express it on the page a little easier.
That's you know, hey, Fran, Alan Topol, David made really an interesting point. I just want to dwell on a little bit for your listeners, because I think it's really key. Is what he said is that he describes, he writes down on a paper, if I understood him right, to understand his characters. And I do that too. Before I pick up my pen to write anything or the computer about the book, I write out for myself, as David said, detailed profiles of the characters. I have to understand those characters. I have to know who they are before I can begin writing. And David mentioned that in passing. But, you know, for your listeners, if they're trying to write, it's really, really a good exercise. Describe everything. I don't mean physical descriptions, what they're like, what their backgrounds are, how they grew up, what their emotional interests are, and all that sort of stuff. You have to know those people before you can write about them. And I think that's really a key point for people who are trying to write. I really do.
I agree with you. As a matter of fact, when all of you write, I could actually close my eyes and visualize where you are, where the character is. I could feel what Karen Bale is, and I can even hear her voice when she gets in trouble and does the wrong thing. I can hear Craig Page, because, you know, he's one of my favorite people. And Linda wrote in two voices, Abbott and Della, and I fell in love with both of those characters. I can't wait for her to write the next one. So even when Christina Maggs told the story, and that was great because he was the gangster. And it took me a while to get to understand him. And then I said, well, this is a book I didn't expect, which is great. And I just read Concrete Smile by Bernard Mestis, which is really about gangs. And I hope I don't know if they have gangs in Hawaii, but that's where he's from. And the book is so violent. It was interesting how you can think you're going to win against them and you don't. So character voice, how many people write in the present, past, or future tense, or do you choose one tense, or do you do flashbacks, which would be in the past? And some people even use an unreliable narrative voice, which is the voice of somebody that you're telling the story, but you can't trust that person. So how many of you use the different tenses or even an unreliable narrator?
Everybody, when you're going through, this is David McHale, by the way, when you're going through someone's head, when you're in your character's head, to a degree, all characters are unreliable. I mean, because everybody views the world from their slant. So I have not used anybody, however, that is, you know, mentally unstable or that is very obviously unreliable. So I typically have a reliable narrator, but everybody, it depends on what character it is. The reader is aware of their biases. But it's all third person, past tense.
I love unreliable narrators. I think they're super interesting. I love writing them and I love reading them. I love past tense, and I find reading and writing in present tense kind of annoying. I did write a YA novel. And I changed it all because I noticed that YA, for some reason, is mostly written in present tense. So I went through and doggedly changed all my past tenses to present tenses and helped a little with the voice. Again, it was difficult to nail that teen voice. Most YA novels are in first person present tense. But to create that sense of immediacy, you're in the now, kind of, again, that seems to be the style of writing for teens. So I did it for that. But I found it kind of annoying. I'm not a big fan of present tense. But, you know, again, once you get into the story, you don't really seem to notice that. You know, you just sort of flows on. But I still stick to past tense.
Hey, Christine Alan Topol, I share your view. I find the present annoying, too. The question I always wrestle with in terms of Fran's thing is, you know, the flashbacks. I mean, if you want to put a flashback in, I mean, it's one thing to put it in interior monologue for a character. Then it's easy. It flows. It's short. But occasionally I've wrestled with putting in a just jumping around and putting it into a just a separate little flashback scene, and maybe even trying the present tense for that. But I don't know. It hasn't really worked terribly well, and my agent's all over me and saying these things don't work. But I mean, but I'd just be interested to hear what the other people on this call do with flashbacks. Do they work them in the interior monologue or narration, or do they actually put in a couple ellipses and jump back and tell the story 20 years ago for a few pages?
Hi, Alan Jacobson here. Go ahead.
No, please go ahead, Alan.
I've done all of it, Alan, to some extent. Your agents are correct, in my opinion, in that flashbacks are very tricky and they should be utilized at a minimum. And when you do go into the flashback, you have to absolutely make sure that the reader understands what's happening. And, you know, you can do that certainly with italics, but the problem is italics get very fatiguing, you know, after a few paragraphs. And, you know, I have done a flashback here or there. I've toyed with using italics, but, you know, you really have to, especially if you're using a different time period, then it's a little easier because you can introduce something in the exterior world that the character's in to help illustrate that it's in the past, whether it be a car or a song on the radio or clothing or a hairstyle or something that puts the person there and the reader can instantly grasp that this is a flashback. But you got to be careful. It's jarring to the reader. I wrote, in fact, it was a couple of novels that were part historical novel, even though it's a thriller suspense novel. There were two that I wrote where we go back in time. And there was one, and Fran knows, Spectrum, that Karenville number 6, that took place over three different time periods or three different storylines, and the time period changed each time we visited with that storyline. So that was a huge challenge for me in making sure the reader was on board with which storyline we're in, which time period we're in, because all three timelines come together toward the end, and they are all relevant to one another. So that was an incredibly difficult challenge to make sure I stayed with it. So that was not a flashback because it was told moving forward, but part of it was in the 70s, part of it was in the 90s, and part of it was in the present day. So you can do it. It's just another layer of complexity for the writer to make sure that you manage everything properly and keep the reader with you. We even went as to use a different font for the header for each chapter that was in a different time frame.
That's right, because as a reviewer, sometimes I can't tell. I could be reading a paragraph and I go like, wait a minute, didn't I just read that in the present, and how come they're 20 years in the past? And then I get the book. One of the books I just finished, the author wanted to do a flashback of how the character met her boyfriend. So what he did was he had literally a conversation there, one in italics, as if you were writing a conversation with, you know, question and answer. That's how he did it. That's how I knew that it was a flashback. But sometimes you could be in the middle of a page and go like, huh? Wait a minute. Didn't die somewhere? Yeah, and it makes it kind of hard to follow. So when Alan, you know, writes it, I follow it in three different time periods was a piece of cake. Nah, no problem. I got that. But how do you get in this situation, our narrator is there, but what happens when do you switch from past tense, present tense, future tense, and then is there ever a narrator that no one wants to listen to? Is there ever a narrator that you would rather change or not have in your novel? Sometimes these narrators, you know, I write in first person, I'm sorry, but I'm writing it from the point of view of the dead body that did something wrong behind a gravestone. So I'm listening and saying, well, how do you elicit some kind of, make the person want to read the plot as to what the person did wrong so they got there? So what would I have to put in there to change it? Everybody likes what I write. It's just that I want to make it even better.
Mm-hmm.
That's a tough one.
Well, yeah, it is a tough one. It may be hard to answer without seeing the material, but there was one author, mm-hmm. a big author. I won't mention his name because of about what I'm about to say, but mm-hmm. he started the book with one narrator, mm-hmm. his main character, and then 50 to 75 pages in, he killed the character. And he passed it off to a secondary character who I didn't really like near as much. And suddenly, you know, I'm in this book and I'm going, oh, wow, okay, I was really enjoying this book and now not so much. You know, that's another consideration, that he was trying to do something original and fresh, I guess. But if you're going to do that, you have to make sure that the person, the narrator, you're handing the story, the point of view off to, whose eyes were seeing the rest of the story, is as compelling mm-hmm. and as interesting and likable and emotionally engaging as the one you just killed off. So, narration point of view is absolutely mm-hmm. essential. And we haven't even talked about omniscient, which I'm not a fan of, and mm-hmm. I find it very difficult to read a novel that's written in the omniscient point of view, which is basically the narrator is in everybody's head simultaneously or whenever he wants to be or she wants to be. And I find it a very, very tough read for me. Anybody else have that?
No, I agree. Yeah, no, it's Alan Topol. I totally agree with you. I mean, I've got to have a point of view, and, you know, there's some authors, they'll, within the mm-hmm. same chapter or same scene, will jump around for three or four mm-hmm. characters in the same scene. And well, wait a minute, what the hell's going on here? I'm not understanding anything. I'm not getting it, really. It's,
right.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
It seems that it's more of an old-fashioned, the third-person omniscient narration. It's a little bit antiquated mm-hmm. to me. And I notice also a trend in mystery and thriller writing is the detective is much more first-person. The detective mm-hmm. is now, you know, narrating his or her own story. I notice that trend. I think there's a much more stronger trend, maybe driven by the memoir, since they became mm-hmm. popular 10, 15 years ago, into first-person mm-hmm. narration. But I agree. I think it's hard to pull off as an author, too, because you risk that head-hopping thing. That's what that's why I've steered away from it, because how do you do a third-person omniscient when it doesn't become sort of head-hopping into different characters all over the place?
Right. It's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard to get to close to any one particular character, because even if the reader doesn't notice it, you're subconsciously distancing them whenever
right.
you're moving from one place to another, and you can never really get close into and get back to what we were talking about at first, which is the feeling and the emotion, because once mm-hmm. you do, all of a sudden you're in someone's head. Well, then when you want to be able to move into someone else's head, then again you're distancing the reader. So there are pros and cons to it, but I agree. It tends to be an older style, and mm-hmm. most folks like the single point of view, because that's how we observe life.
I agree 100%. I think the omniscient is easier. I hate to use this term because some authors still write it, but to me it's almost a lazier way of doing things, because you can be in multiple heads and viewpoints simultaneously. So if you want to show the reader something, you just hop into their head and show them or tell them. So I've never been a fan of that. Another one that, and Christine mentioned this earlier, was first person or rather present tense being mm-hmm. jarring. I too find that. In fact, there's one writer, Steve Martini, who writes first person present. And I started reading Steve many 20 something years ago, and he his work stimulated me. I would always have to go and write, and this was very early in my career before I had gotten published. Whenever I read his his books, I'd have to go and write myself. So I found it very stimulating, but he's the only author that I can read who writes first person present. It's very jarring to me to read present tense. I've tried, and sometimes I can get through it, but it's different. It's a very different construct, and I don't know if I had started reading Steve Martini now, if I'd be able to, if I would look at it the same way. But I know his characters in the first person present, so it's just natural. But and it's kind of unusual. First person present is an unusual, just like second person. I don't think that would be really strange. Second person point of view.
David, did you read Blood Flag by Stephen? Did you read Blood Flag by Stephen Martini? That was fantastic. I read everything that he wrote, and I understand
you
what
like
you're
him?
Saying
yeah,
because
he's great.
That book was fantastic, and you're right. First person present is hard, and he's amazing. His Paul Medriani books are absolutely great, and I could read him all day long. But sometimes when you're writing, even I know both Alan's do it, and Linda did it, and Max is really good at this. How do you create satire through the narrator? And do you ever have a narrator that's really like doesn't know what's happening? Or that exposes the faults in the other characters? Do you ever have a character, a naive narrator, or someone that creates, that you created satire or irony through them?
I think you can do that with little wry comments, you know, as the narrator is observing the things going around him or her. You can sort of have him making these little wry, you know, ironic comments in their head, and I think that's very effective. It can add something to the character, definitely, by making little observations.
Yeah, my character. This is Linda speaking, and my character Abbott contributed to the show not tell by being, he was a young man who had been kind of dissed throughout his life, and he just was puzzled by the world, and so he was always sort of dropping these things about where things I wanted to show weren't right. You know, he was able to bring it up because he was flummoxed by the world that he kept seeing. So there's lots of writers' tricks of the trade that we can use. Like back to the thing about flashbacks, you know, the old the horn started honking, like you're daydreaming while you're in traffic, and then the horn honks, or, you know, something less prosaic than that. But you can bring the reader back with these tricks of the trade that you know, one of the things I always, when I teach writing, I always teach is, even though I am expressing myself creatively, it's essential that I keep my reader in mind. And I know everybody on this call does that too. And that is, yes, it's my book, my creativity, but I am scrupulous about making sure my reader knows where my readers know where they are, what's happening, and they're not confused. So we have a lot of tricks of the trade that you can use, like tools to help you keep your reader comfortable and turning the pages.
Helped me when I read your book was that you had chapter headings. So I knew which one was Deller, and I knew which one was Abbott. I know in Alan and Alan's books and Lisa and Christina's books and David, I knew where it was. But there are times when the author just goes off and they don't have the chapter headings. You don't know where the time period is. You don't know where it's going. And the chapter doesn't, it just says chapter 10, chapter 12, and you have to guess. So how do you deal with that? Fran, as a reviewer, it's hard, let me tell you.
Well, Fran, I want to come back, Fran, for a minute to what you said about satire and stuff, because humor, we're all talking about writing serious novels, thriller, suspense, and humor is kind of tricky. And there are a couple of very well-known, and they sell a lot of books, authors, whose characters, lead characters, they've given a very sort of smart alecky kind of personality
mm-hmm.
in their books,
mm-hmm.
and I find that so annoying. I mean, the story's good, the writing's good, but I just hate those smart alecky characters, and I'm sure everybody on this phone can guess it. Who a couple of the writers are. And, you know, they write
mm-hmm.
terrific books and stuff, but I find that so off-putting, the smart-alecky character. I don't know, maybe other people, doesn't work for me. I don't know, maybe others on this call feel differently about that. Humor.
Well,
no,
I think that comes down, though, to something that I think is really important for all of us and the listeners to keep in mind is that there's something for everyone. And when
yeah.
it comes to reviews, I got some critiques on
mm-hmm.
things they didn't like that I had two points of view, like two characters, I mean. And I just had to say, okay, that's your little
yeah.
world. And
okay.
so, you know, if somebody's doing well with snarky books, hey, that's
mm-hmm.
for a certain audience, but it's not us, maybe. So
right.
it helps me when I get a review that I always ponder them and think, well,
yeah.
is that valid? Well, it's valid for that
mm-hmm.
person, but it's not necessarily
mm-hmm.
going to change my style. And so anyway, I just think that's a huge world out there, and there's room for everybody.
Yeah, humor is kind of difficult in thrillers. I had a lot of humor in my first book, and honestly, I had to take a lot of it out just because it ended up kind of coming across dorky. And so what, you know, someone that actually does it well, though, is Nelson DeMille. He
yeah.
kind of has a sarcastic humor
yeah,
in his
right,
character sometimes, and
mm-hmm.
I really enjoy. I thought he did it well, and like I say, I had to take a lot of it out just because it, like I say, it just didn't fit. You know, I'm trying to weave it back in as I go along, though.
It works for him. It works for DeMille. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right with his character.
Yeah,
although even then, it becomes excessive sometimes. I mean,
you're right. You're
I
right.
don't know.
Yeah, I would say that Karen Vale is kind of the female version of John Corey, Nelson DeMille's main sarcastic character. And you know, I found that when I wrote The Seventh Victim, a lot of Vale's sarcasm was out front, and you know, some of it was internal, but she also didn't hesitate to make the comments to others. And I've toned that down as the series has gone on, beginning with Crush, which was the second one. It started to become more of an internal joke or sarcasm, and I think that worked better, certainly in terms of her relationship to others. She kind of and that was part of the growth
mm-hmm.
of the character. She realized that she gets along better with others if she keeps it
mm-hmm.
to herself, and it works. With the reader, works for the reader too, because we're still seeing that that humor, but it's not at somebody else's expense in their face, so it's a little bit more palatable. But I think humor is very important. It has
mm-hmm.
to be in the right place, obviously. You can have, in a very tense situation, you know, somebody's bleeding out, you don't want to crack a joke. That's just in poor taste. It would not go over well. So, you know, right situation, right character, and a good zinger is just, you know, it's great. I think it adds a tremendous dimension. And the funny thing is that when I write my novels, because there tends to be a lot of humor in my books, and when I write them, I don't feel the humor while I'm writing it. But when I go back and I read the first draft, I go, wow, okay, there was more than I thought. And I love it,
mm-hmm.
and I'm glad that it's there. But it's not something I try for. It just, you know, it's organic. It just happens.
But you hit a good point, and that's, say, between two characters. And Fran, you obviously know my characters,
mm-hmm.
Craig and Elizabeth. And,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, in all the Craig and Elizabeth novels, there's a certain amount of back and forth dialogue with them. Their relationship evolves. It's not perfect. It's got ups and downs. And there's a certain amount of back and forth with them. And I find too, I have to tone it down because otherwise the reader's going to, I mean, they're not interested in just, you know, watching these two sort of spar at each other with their little comments. Maybe less is more is maybe a good way to approach the subject, I think. I don't know.
Well, before I forget, because I don't want to forget, Thursday at 10 Eastern, I'm forgetting the times lately, John Land will be here with Heather Graham, and we're going to talk about The Rising. On the 26th, James will be here, Jones will be here for Child's Play. And on the 30th, I have Linda and Christina and Larry and David, and we're going to talk about voice and point of view. That should be interesting. February 2nd, Nightbird with Brian Freeman. That should be absolutely fantastic. And I am totally honored to be interviewing John Land, David Morrell, and Andrew Gross on the 16th of February. We're going to talk about mood and tone. And they asked to talk about it, and I'm really excited. So that should be fun. And, of course, for those of you that don't know what books to read, you might want to read every book by every author on this show today, which would be fantastic. And since Mother's Day and Father's Day is not too far away, and Valentine's Day is a great day to buy somebody a bouquet of books. No, I'm serious. My sister used to put them in a vase from in a big basket with flowers and a bunch of books because she knows that's what I really wanted. So I miss that.
That's great.
So do you use a narrator to describe an event that is about to happen, or just let it happen with the dialogue? Now, I know Karen Vale uses, she's funny though. She's not sarcastic annoying, where some characters, and I've read, 5,000 books, seriously, that I go like, oh, help me, don't do this to me, no, I can't stand the flippant stuff. Yeah, I hate that too, it drives me crazy. So do you use a character to describe an event that is going to happen, or an impending doom or something, so that we sort of get an idea, so that when I'm reading it and I don't go, huh?
Well, Alan Jacobson here. I've foreshadowed, so we know something could happen, something might happen. We're trying and hoping that it doesn't happen, and trying to make it not happen. So when it happens, if it happens, certainly we've been prepared for it, but we don't know how it's going to happen, when it's going to happen, or if it's going to happen. So that's one technique. I've never used a character to foreshadow, to specifically, other than foreshadowing, state that an event is going to happen. There are various techniques of writing where you write backwards, where you start the book off with an event that has happened, and then you go back in time and show how it's going to happen, and another technique that can be very effective. It's a backwards way of telling a story that someday I might try, because it's a new and fresh challenge to an author to do something like that. You got to think differently. The whole construct.
Stephen King did that
story.
King did that with he did it with a book, and I had to read it forwards and backwards to review it. That he told the story and I didn't realize it, that he was telling it from the ending to the beginning. And I'm saying, I have to review this book. So I read it the front way, and then I wrote it backwards, so I got the sequence of events. It was fantastic. But if you don't realize what he did, you're going to say, like, didn't that happen before? And how come that happened now? So I just read the book backwards. It was easier.
I got to ask you, which way did you enjoy it more, going backwards or forwards, which was the reverse in each case?
Actually, it was really kind of fun reading it the right way, from the last event to the first, to see if I was smart enough to figure it out, which I did. So it was fun. Once I got through it, I said, I'm being tortured again. Oh, my God, why am I doing this? And I said, this is Stephen King, and only he could write something like that. And then at the end, you find out, oh, my God, that really was a scam, wasn't it? And you think, the characters were great. It's just that I don't want to do that again. No, it's okay. So it's hard. Narrators describing an event that's happening at the same time. And did anybody ever write in entirely future tense? Because I get authors that write in the past, the present, in the future, in the further future, and you could. It's difficult, and I don't think either any one of you write in the future future tense, do you?
No, that's not how you experience life.
I don't know if I've ever really seen that. It's sort of like second person, you know, which it smacks of sort of experimental or avant-garde writing, you know, that you will do this or you will, you know, it's almost sort of he will do, you know, like God's voice from above commanding somebody, he's going to do this, you know. So it would be it would be an interesting experiment for sure. I don't know if it would be a popular mode of narration, but hey, why not, you know?
I read a second person present once, and I don't remember if I finished it. It was so difficult to get through. It was so outlandish in many respects. I had a hard time relating to it and focusing on the story. It was almost too different to flow. Yeah.
It is. And as a reviewer, I appreciate the fact that all of you write so I can understand it and follow. And I know I'm in trouble if there's like 17 different plot lines. And I don't know, what is the most plot line that you would write? Three plots or several subplots? But I know when I have to get my education, my graphic organizer that I used to use when I was teaching reading in school out, I know I'm in trouble because then I have to write character plot details and I start writing what's happening in order to make sure that I don't mess up when I write the review or interview the person. So does anybody
there's a phrase I was taught a while back, and it's the reader is always in trouble. And as writers, we need to keep that in mind. The reader is always in trouble, whether it deals with plots, whether it deals with flashbacks. We need to kind of do enough signaling just to make sure that they know exactly where they're at in any particular time. And that's also why you have reviewers, so that or folks that you know that read your work before you give it to your editors, just because you think you've got everything done, and then lo and behold, they take something that you did not intend it to be taken one particular way, and they'll interpret it a different manner, and it's a valid point. You have to be able to adjust those things, and so it's good to be able to get other people to look at your book so that before you send it off to your editor, so that hopefully they can catch things, and so that when, like I say, when whether it be point of view, whether it be different plot, whether it be different plot lines that aren't quite, that are kind of a little bit confusing, but just keeping in mind, you got to keep the reader at the forefront at all times when you're writing.
You're right, because as a reviewer, I've read books before they've come out, and I've given people my opinion in editorial reviews, and probably had they listened to what I was telling them, then probably the book would be a whole lot better. Because after reviewing and reading all of your work and everyone else, I pretty much can tell, even in my own work, oh my God, that's not really good, that doesn't flow, that doesn't make sense. So do you ever read a plot or a novel told by only one narrator at different time periods in this character's voice? Would you ever write something like that?
Well, yeah, I did. There's Alan Jacobson and Spectrum. We see Karen Vale in two different time periods, the 90s, working forward through to the present. And then we see her in the present trying to solve this case that has been, bicycling through the 70s, 90s, and the present time. So that was a challenge for me because I'd only written Karen Vale in the present, and then suddenly I had to go back in time to her first day on the job as an NYPD beat cop. So, I mean, she's just graduated the academy, and I'm used to writing Karen Vale as one of the foremost FBI profilers. So it was an adjustment to think of my character not only as a 20-year-old, but as somebody who doesn't know really what she's doing. She's kind of feeling her way. She's got the book smarts, but she's got no street smarts. So it was an adjustment for me. And I was actually very concerned about that before I started writing. But within the first paragraph of writing, it just came naturally to me. I guess, after writing her for so many years and so many books, I know who she is at the core. And I was able to think as a 20-year-old, and then moving forward through her career. But it was a great deal of fun to write because it forced me to see my main character a narrator in a totally different way and from different perspectives. So I did exactly what you just asked.
That's interesting. So if you do you use different chapter headings, or when you write a book, because I'm reading so many of them, that when it goes to chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, that drives me crazy. And if you have like a heading telling me it takes place in a specific time period or specific setting or specific person speaking, which do you find is easier for the reader to understand? Because there are a lot of people, if you look at some of Amazon reviews, you're going to realize that you just have to discount them, because half the time the people don't even read the book. They're just rewording
the back
cover, or they're giving
you.
And to me, when they say the book is really bad or it's fantastic, that's not a review. That's giving your opinion. And I discount those also, because everybody gets those too. So do you use chapter headings? How does your reader know?
Yeah, I use, Fran, it's Alan Topol, I use places because, as you know, my books jump around among international locales. And so when the reader starts a new chapter, I want the reader to know where they are. I don't want them to, you know, obviously from the first two paragraphs, they're hopefully going to find out from the context, but I don't want them to have to guess. So rather than put a number up there, 6, 7, I want to put Washington, Beijing, Paris, Milan, because, you know, I want to, it sort of, it helps the reader, I think, and then it lets him or her keep going without a lot of, worrying and trying to help the reader. But that's kind of my take on why I use chapter headings, just to orient the reader on place.
I think that's a good idea. You can also do that with time. If you are skipping back in time, you know, with years, also if you're changing points of view, you know, you can put John, it's John's story in this chapter, and then Mary in the next, and again, that really helps the reader. So I think, I think it's valuable to do that.
Yeah, Linda, I have seen that done, particularly when you've got different characters, and I've never written a book like that with multiple points of view, and you can see it from different people's perspectives. I think that would be very interesting to do. But I always try when I am in different times and or places, because I do different places a lot more frequently than I do jumping through time. But I will use a header when it's appropriate. I mean, it's not always needed. If you can tell, if the reader is oriented right away and it's a flowing story, you don't need a header or a dateline. But if you are in multiple timelines or multiple story lines where the reader needs some orientation more than just a reference in the first paragraph, I definitely use a header. The problem, some readers skip over it. They don't read the headers, I've found. But so sometimes you gotta do both.
But David, you might want to play with the shifting point of view the next time you sit down to write something, because it's kind of fun. I didn't think I'd like it as much as I do, but it opens up opportunity. I don't know, Christine, what do you think, or Alan?
One of the points we haven't made about first person is that it does limit your story to that particular character. So you're only seeing it through that character's eyes. So when you do open it up and say use two viewpoints, and again, that's one danger, and I just read a book by a British author, there were too many points of view. It was ridiculous. Every chapter had a different character. It was silly. But, if you have one or two, possibly three, viewpoints, you can get more angles. You can explore more of your story and different observations and different characters, obviously. So it can open up the story for you. And it's kind of interesting if you have two opposed, if you have the detective and the villain and go back
that's
and forth, ask. Creating more of a cat and mouse kind of a suspense.
Exactly. Or the head of the Chinese government going at it with Craig Page. I mean, what is the head of the Chinese government planning and why? I mean, to me, you can't get that except from the shifting point of view, because we got to get in the mind of that Chinese president.
Right.
Well, I've read some books where the villain starts telling the story in the prologue. And would you ever tell a story, this one or two last questions before the time will be up. Do you ever tell a story from the point of view narrated by the villain, by the bad guy? before he's about to do something?
Yeah, Alan Jacobson here. I did that in the first Karen Vale. It was the killer, the serial killer. We see, I wouldn't say half the story, but a good portion of the story. You know, it's alternating between his point of view and Karen Vale's. And, I found that fascinating. It really allowed me to get into the head of a serial killer. I'd done all those years of research learning about what a serial killer does, why he does what he does, and how, and conversely how the profilers do it. So I was in, obviously, Karen Vale's head as a profiler, but it allowed me to get into the killer's head, and that was just a tremendous exercise as a writer.
Yeah, ditto for me on International Leaders, same thing, Alan Jacobson. I'm right with you there.
I think it's actually a lot of fun getting those heads. I love writing it.
Yeah, I can appreciate the antagonist point of view. I just haven't I haven't really utilized it in my writing. I enjoy reading and getting into the point of view, but with my books in particular, I've actually tried to present them really again as kind of we see life. And so, from my protagonist perspective, I didn't want to kind of provide that perspective to the reader, something that the protagonist wasn't privy to. And so it's just a different style. I'm not saying one's right or wrong. I'm just saying that's the way I chose to write my novels.
Okay, so before we end, everybody has to tell everybody where to find you and what's coming next and when am I getting it? Seriously. So, Linda, we'll start with you. When is your next book coming out? When am I getting the sequel and where can we learn about everybody?
Well, let's see. It's coming out the end of this year, late fall, and it's the second in the series. And, it's Linda McDaniel Books is my website. It's Linda with a Y. And you can read more about that and links to Amazon there and that kind of thing. So
that's good. And, Christina, when am I getting the sequel to yours?
I don't know. I've got it sort of, it's hanging in there, but I'm currently working on a thriller more designed to be a series of an international journalist, kind of based on myself and, solving things. Works for an investigative website and goes around the world, tracking down, exposing, investigating, and solving mysteries, that kind of thing. So I don't know when that, hopefully this year I'll finish it at some point. And I'm at Christina Hoag, HOAG.com. So you can find out about me there.
And David, when am I getting your next one? And what's next for you?
Reload. It's coming out in August, and you will get it as soon as my editor says I can send it to you. It's it takes place in North Korea and China and here in the U.S. and really looking forward to it. I'm really looking forward to it.
Good, and we'll have to do an interview just with you on that book. That would be really great. I would look forward to it. And Alan is coming out. Tell everybody about the darkness of that character that you. Oh my God. You got an evil character, and we won't tell the twist that no one's going to get at the end of the book. That's coming out March 7th, and my review's not coming out before March 7th. So tell us about where they can find about you, and tell us about the darkness of evil, because, boy, is that evil. Oh, my God.
So The Darkness of Evil is the seventh Karen Vale novel, and the whole concept behind it was, these serial killers, most of them have families, and to me, that was just a fascinating thought of what it's like as being, a wife or a child of a serial killer. And in particular, we know almost all these serial killers are male. So what if you were the daughter of a serial killer and you found out that your dad was a monster? How would you? So that was the jumping off point for The Darkness of Evil. It was a great deal of fun to tell that story, and I will get into it more when we do the interview, Fran, on that. But so that, as you said, that comes out March 7th. It's available for pre-order now. And where can you find me? Well, my website is alanjacobson.com, and that's A-L-A-N. jacobson.com. I'm on Instagram at alan.jacobson, Facebook, Alan Jacobson Fans. You can also go, I've got a number of Facebook groups. Some are run by fans, some are run by my publisher. You know, so you'll, if you go to one, you'll find the others. And of course, I'm on Twitter at Jacobson Allen. So I'm all over the place, and I've got an Amazon author page. So yeah, I'm not hard to find.
This is true, but I find people. You know, I found Christina this morning, and they're like, wait a minute, didn't I friend her before? I should have done that. And Alan Topol, where can we find you, and when am I getting the Washington Law? I have about 50 books inside that are staring at me, and I have one that I have to read for a blog tour. So you guys, you know, get to the top of my list when I get them. When is your book coming out, and when am I getting it?
Okay. Okay, so I'm Alan, ALLANTOPOL.com. It'll be my 13th novel called The Washington Power Play. It's a follow-up to The Washington Lawyer, which came out 2 years ago. It's not a Craig Page, but The Washington Lawyer did very well, and so I'm back to Washington with The Washington Power Play. It has a middle of May pub date, and I promise you, Fran, as soon as I get clear, typed copy, you don't need an ARC, you get clean copy, it's going to be on its way to you, so you can be sure of that, Fran.
Oh, I'm excited. Thank you so much. Well, I want to thank everybody for today. I really appreciate it. I can't wait to read your next books. And David, whenever I get your book, I will email you so we can do an interview either in August and September to talk about your book and promote it. And is everybody going to the Filler Fest this year? Because I hope John Lamb reminds himself that he's going to tell me.
Absolutely.
I will definitely be there to wave at everybody. And
I
really
will be
excited.
There.
This is really. Oh, you're going to be there? Good. I can finally say hello in person.
Yes. We'll have to definitely hook up.
We have to hook up with everybody.
Oh,
that's good. That's even better, because this way you can hand me your next book after that one. And I take books. I like autograph books, and I do actually do blurbs for back covers, and I have fun doing it. So thank you so much for today. I'm doing the next one on January 30th with the same people, Christina Hook, Linda McDaniels, David McCallum. Larry Farmer will be here. As a matter of fact, he emailed me just now because he lost connection, and he said that he writes in first person. I know, because I'm reading his new book, Seeing Gail Again, and he likes first person writing. He said it helps him write, and he enjoys writing in narrative, and his books are really interesting, and he does have dialogue in between the first person, so that's good. And then Bruce Coffin will be here, Among the Shadows, so that should be interesting. Everybody have a great day, and thank you so much, and until next time. And anybody else that wants to join on the 30th, just let me know. The more the better. I don't mind. Have a nice day, and bye.
Thank you, Fran.
Thanks, Fran. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.